Hey everybody, this is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Robinhood.com. I know you have sat back before and wanted to get involved in the stock market. You've wanted to buy stock in Amazon, Microsoft, Google, GM, Facebook, Nike, Visa, Sony, Uber, Walmart, PayPal, Disney, Coca-Cola, GE, Apple, all of these companies that seem to be all over the place, Netflix, all of these ones, man. But you don't know how to go about it. You don't work on Wall Street. Hell, you probably don't even have a college degree. Who cares? It's the 21st century. Don't pay a commission to these losers that'll charge you 15% just to push a button from some high rise in New York City. Go to Robinhood.com today. Set up an account. It's easy as 1, 2, 3. Robinhood.com is investing for everyone. It's the easiest place to learn as you go, learn as you grow, commission-free investing, plus the tools you need to put your money in motion. Sign up and get your first stock for free. Yeah, certain limitations apply, but that's okay. Break free from commission fees. Like I said, make unlimited commission-free trades in stocks, ETFs, and options with Robinhood Financial. And guess what? As well as buy the hottest cryptocurrencies with Robinhood Crypto. But how much is a Bitcoin today? One Bitcoin is like $33,000 regular dollars. I know you don't have that, but that's okay. Robinhood has fractional shares. You can invest in thousands of stocks and cryptocurrencies with as little as $1. Invest any amount. Choose how much you want to invest, and they will convert from dollars to parts of a whole share. Amazon costs like $3,300 for one share. Don't have $3,300 laying around? Maybe you only have $33? Well, you'll get $33 worth of a $3,300 stock. It's called a fractional share. You can build a balanced portfolio this way. You can invest in a whole wide variety of companies, and you can customize your portfolio with pieces of different companies and funds to help reduce risk. You can also trade in real time. All trades placed during market hours are executed at that time, so you'll always know the share price. You can also keep tabs on your money. You can set up a customized news and notifications to stay on top of your assets as casually or as relentlessly as you like. Controlling the flow of info is up to you. You get to manage your portfolio. You have your portfolio in your pocket, in your smartphone. Everything you need to manage your assets is available in a single app, and you don't have to deal with any loser elitist on Wall Street that isn't any smarter than the person on the corner selling bagels, but because he has a college degree, he gets to charge you money to buy and sell stocks for you? That's nonsense. It's always been nonsense, but now it's the 21st century and you have Robinhood.com, proud supporters of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Enjoy the episode. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. And today we are going to explore another little avenue of addiction recovery. I know that this podcast is kind of weird. We get addiction recovery and mental health. Then we get long rants of political issues and other things, and then memorials about friends that I've lost. I know this is all over the place, but it's really just what's on my mind at the time and what I want to talk about, and that's all it is. I thought I would do a kind of a special little dive into each of the 12 steps in addiction recovery, or Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, anything like that. I want to kind of personalize my experiences around each of the steps. And today we will start with step one. Step one is the biggest and hardest step for many people to make. It is about honesty. And step one is that you admit that you of yourself are powerless to overcome your addictions and that your life has become unmanageable. Seems like a simple statement. For people who are in the throes of addiction, it's clear to everybody around them that they are powerless, that their life is out of control, is unmanageable, but that denial that is so real and so thick it's like a cloud is over the person's head. And they just can't see things for what they really are. And it's very hard to admit that, especially when you pride yourself of being, a type A personality, somebody who has overcome a lot of things, a strong leader, a soldier, a firefighter, a father, a husband, or whatever you are, a professional. There's many doctors and lawyers and, there are people that have accomplished things in their lives and never needed help from anybody. It's very hard to get to that point where you have to admit that, man, I just can't do this alone. I just can't do this on my own. I need help. And I can't do it anymore. That is a very, very hard place to get to. Very hard. And in different points of your recovery, when you may have attained some sobriety and then you have taken steps back and you've relapsed and you're back in the insanity again, it's even harder to admit again that, again, I need help overcoming this thing that I have previously overcome. I talked about that in an episode a few weeks back about that second great denial. Denial in all of its forms is one of the biggest barriers and enemies to health and welfare and recovery from addictions. You know, whether you yourself struggle with addiction or you associate with someone that does, usually a loved one or a friend, the 12 steps, there's many different adaptations and different things, but at the root of them, the 12 steps that were originally developed by Alcoholics Anonymous, is I know and I can attest that if worked properly, if done exactly the way that they tell you to do it, and the key to this is continuously applying them and continuously going through them to make sure that you're always on top of your recovery, that is the key. And it's not just a one and done thing. It's not just, oh, I did the steps, it's over, I'm done, I'll never have to look at those again. It's just not the way that it works, unfortunately. So step one is categorized by honesty. Admit that you of yourself are powerless to overcome your addictions and that your life has become unmanageable. Rarely do people caught in addictive behaviors admit to being addicted. To deny the seriousness of our condition and to avoid detection and the consequences of our choices, we tried to minimize or hide our behaviors. We did not realize that by deceiving others and ourselves, we slipped deeper into our addictions. As our powerlessness over addiction increased, many of us found fault with family, friends, or other leaders, even God. We plunged into greater and greater isolation, separating ourselves from others, especially from God. When we as addicts resorted to lies and secrecy, hoping to excuse ourselves or blame others, we weakened spiritually. With each act of dishonesty, we bound ourselves with flaxen cords that soon became as strong as chains. Then a time came when we were brought face to face with reality. We could no longer hide our addictions by telling one more lie or saying it's not that bad. I've had this realization many times, the first of which when I was probably 18 years old, where I could really honestly come to grips with the fact that I do, in fact, suffer from addiction and I can't do it on my own and I need help. But I wish to talk a little bit more about my more recent bout with this insanity that it talks about. When I had relapsed several weeks before my overdose, I immediately, within two or three times of using, fell right back into that grip, that those flaxen cords became like chains bound about me. And I cannot put words to it, because I knew what was happening. I knew where it was going to take me. I knew that whatever I was dealing with, that was not the answer. But I just could not find the strength and the will to stop and reverse course and go get the help that I needed. I rationalized everything. Oh, I have so much riding. I so many people depend on me. you know, I mean so much to so many people in terms of being successful in addiction recovery, being a public elected official, being a candidate for office, a father, a husband. Like, I can't, I'm okay. I will figure this out. I know what I need to do. It's not that bad. I got it under control. I can manage this. We could no longer hide. The time came when we were brought face to face with reality. For me, it was an experience that I'll never forget. When I went into that bathroom and locked the door and did that last shot of heroin, right after putting my angel of a daughter to bed, immediately I knew that something was different, something was wrong. I felt the rush hit me very hard. It's like a million ants biting the back of your neck and overcoming your head. It feels like ant bites. When you get that high without passing out, that's a good thing, because you know that that shot hits you and it was, you know, it's gonna, the effects are gonna be euphoric. But this time it was immediately my heart jumped out of my chest. I mean, it was beating so fast. I was looking in the mirror and I was just telling myself, okay, control your breathing. As a firefighter, as a combat veteran, I've learned how to control my breathing in very tense adrenaline dump situations. And that is the difference between living and dying in combat. And it's the difference in conserving your air tank in a house fire, a structure fire, or breathing so fast that your tank depletes in minutes, and then you're stuck and you have to leave your crew and go and get a new tank and everything else. It's just a bad situation. And so I knew that I could try to control my breathing, and I did some breathing exercises real quick to try to slow it down, to stop from hyperventilating. But I couldn't quite, it was like I had it right there like I could reach for it, like control that breathing, and I couldn't grasp it. And so then I started hyperventilating. Remember that my right hand started to involuntarily seize up. It was like going like this, and I couldn't stop it. And then my left hand started to shake, and then I looked down and both of my legs, my knees, were shaking violently, and things were getting very dark, kind of like when you have a what's that editing thing on a photo, the vignette. It was getting darker on the corners of my eyes, and it was like a tunnel coming down, and I was very scared. I was so scared. I mean, that's all I can say. I was terrified what was about to happen. And I, as that darkness started to overcome my field of view, I knew that I had to yell, because I didn't know if my wife had gone to lay down and she may have been already asleep. So I wanted to yell as loud as I could for help. And I remember falling backwards as it went completely dark and attempting to get that cry for help out of my lips, off my lips, out of my mouth. And I didn't get it out, and I fell backwards. 200-pound frame fell on a little plastic stool in my bathroom that my daughter uses to wash her hands and brush her teeth. A dollar store stool. It's like $3, real cheap plastic, you know, but I fell and it completely shattered. I was already out. I remember, though, the last thing that I thought before I went completely black was that I am abandoning my innocent children. My beautiful wife. I am abandoning them for something so stupid. For something that I had overcome, that I had triumphed over, and that I had helped numerous other people overcome as well. How could this be happening? I can't leave them. Please, God, give me another chance. Everything went completely black. But somehow, I don't know how to describe it. Somehow, I was still completely and keenly aware of what had happened. I was just completely out and blacked out, and you know, paralyzed. I couldn't move. I didn't know where I was. I was struck with this overwhelming feeling that, you know, the ramifications of what just happened, and that I was dead or dying. And like I said, that I was leaving. The only thing I could think about was my beautiful children and my wife. And I prayed. I knew that I was in some sort of limbo, because wherever I was, I hadn't yet seen the face of my Creator. So I pled with all of my heart, please let me come back. And right around that time is when I felt a very dark and powerful entity, I don't know, sensation. It was just a dark cloud that enveloped me and had me completely in bondage, just completely tied up. I couldn't move. I couldn't, you know, I was struggling. And I remember thinking, I'm going to fight this with every single ounce that I have left. I am not going to let this power overtake me. I am going to fight to live, to come back. And I put every single ounce of energy and muscle into breaking free from this this evil force that had me completely bound. And I struggled and fought and clawed my way to try to break free. And I couldn't. And I remember feeling that complete muscle failure, like you feel when you're working out and you just can't do anymore. Like every muscle in my body had reached that point of severe exhaustion and muscle failure. And that despair of resigning the fact that, you know, I finally hit rock bottom. I'm dead. I remember thinking, my family is going to comfort each other by saying that I'm in a better place. But it didn't feel like a better place. That my children would have to go on without me. That my beautiful, innocent wife would have to figure things out on her own. I couldn't rationalize anything anymore, because here it is. I'm dead. I died of an overdose at 33 years old. And it was a feeling that of just utter hopelessness and despair, helplessness. And I was still bound by this force. I couldn't move an inch. I couldn't breathe. That's what it was like. It was not just that I was bound by chains, but that I couldn't breathe. I've been choked out before in training. And when that oxygen is cut off, you know, you get into a hypoxic state. And you don't have enough oxygen to have your brain continue to make your body work. And I've also dealt with severe asthma my entire life. And I felt as a young child that scary feeling of not being able to breathe, not having enough air and oxygen going into my lungs. That's what it felt like, as well as being bound, all of my limbs and my body not being able to move, but not being able to breathe. So it was a reality that I faced head on. I mean, I have nowhere, there's no reason to rationalize it anymore. I'm gone, and my family is in turmoil. And And so it seemed like I was in that state for several hours. The first thing I remember is feeling sort of a wheeling sensation, like I was on wheels. And I felt a tightening on my left arm. And I recognized it as a blood pressure cuff. I felt the wisp of oxygen going into my nose. I started to open my eyes and I saw like a light. And I felt somebody holding my hand. And I woke up and realized that it was my father. And that I was in the hospital. And the feeling of comfort feeling of like I survived. I looked over to my left and it was a familiar face. A childhood lifelong friend who is a police sergeant. Told me what had happened and knew that I had overdosed, but I didn't know anything else. Told me that I was revived and that I was combative. I said, "What do you mean? I don't remember any of that." He said, "I know you don't. Don't worry about it. Your dad's going to take you to treatment. You aren't going to jail." I said, "Was anybody hurt? Is everybody okay?" I started crying. Like, how could this happen? How's my wife and my children? So nobody's hurt. You struggled with paramedic. They got you under control. I came in and put you in handcuffs. You got the life-saving drugs and a sedative. And that was basically it. My father and him, at the time he was a church leader of mine as well. And so they gave me a priesthood blessing. And I was there for another couple hours while they did some tests. And then I was discharged, and I drove straight to Tucson, went into the VA detox, and then spent 4 days there, and then went to Phoenix for 40 days for treatment rehab. In that first few hours of fully being aware of what I had just experienced, that was a time when I could no longer hide or rationalize. And I came to full realization that I am powerless. And I don't want to be powerless. I thought that I had learned everything that there was to learn about addiction. I had years in solid recovery. I had helped numerous people attain sobriety themselves. But I was complacent. And I fell back into that insanity. It happens so quickly and so easily. It can happen to anybody. So it's important to always continually work these steps. Always continually go back to step one and say, if I don't do these things, I will become powerless again. And I don't want that to happen. This is step one, honesty. Thanks for listening to this first installment, step one.